supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Grapple, and I'm Naomi Starobin. Last time on Grapple, we heard about Monoy City. It's a small town in northeastern Pennsylvania's coal country that was thriving around the turn of the 20th century. But as the coal industry gradually fell apart, so did the town. And today, Monoy City is officially a financially distressed municipality in Pennsylvania. If you didn't get a chance to hear the episode, definitely check it out. You'll hear personal stories about how blight and home fires are big problems there. With nearly 27% of the homes vacant, people often abandon them because they can't afford to make necessary repairs.
You know, we don't have the jobs to keep a stock of people with money and the resources to invest in their homes and keep them up.
So the prospects aren't great. And we just wonder how a place like Monoy City can turn itself around and what other coal towns are doing to create new economic growth. Later on the show, we'll dig deeper into this idea with Cheryl Gay Stolberg, the Mid-Atlantic bureau chief at the New York Times. But first, we're going to hear from Planet Money co-founder and economics writer Adam Davidson. He spent time reporting in the distressed northeastern Pennsylvania community of Wilkes-Barre, which is less than an hour away from Monoy City. He wrote an article called Blaming Trade and Voting Trump in the Rust Belt for the New York Times Magazine. Davidson is now a contributing writer at NewYorker.com, and he spoke with us at the studios of Gimlet Media in Brooklyn, New York. Before we got into talking about Wilkes-Barre, I asked him if he himself grew up in a distressed community.
Well, I did grow up in a distressed city. I grew up in New York City in the 1970s, which was about the most iconic distressed city before, I guess, Detroit in the modern era, a city that was fundamentally broken. That was a scary place in a lot of ways to grow up. Wonderful, too. But then became the opposite, the model of opulence and wealth all in my lifetime. I grew up in all-artist housing in Greenwich Village. We were in a corner of Greenwich Village that was really just abandoned by the city. The building I grew up in had been Bell Labs. It was surrounded by warehouse buildings and factories that had been abandoned in the 50s. And so there was a public-private effort to bring some artists to this horrible beyond neighborhood and try and revitalize it. And so I grew up surrounded by drug addicts and prostitutes and crime. And I joke, and it's not really a joke, that growing up in all-artist housing in Greenwich Village in the 70s, everything was on the table, sex, drugs, whatever. Everything was cool. Whatever you want to do, but talking about money and finance and economics was that's forbidden. So of course I ran to the
rebellious.
I was rebellious. Exactly. I was never that interested in drugs, but I got very interested in finance, which was more dangerous from where I came from. One thing has been clear for a while in the economic data and is now unavoidably clear in the political discourse, that there is a large percentage of Americans who feel they have lost enormous ground. You know, the shorthand is the non-college educated white male who sort of had the rule of the roost for a long time, especially in the Rust Belt, especially in towns like Wilkes-Barre and Scranton and much of Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana. And that ended. And many of them have seen their opportunities dwindle. They've seen their children who do have opportunity and ambition leave. They've seen the people who stay get lost into opioid addiction. This is a story that I have in my family, more in Massachusetts, but where, you know, we have grandfathers and uncles who triumphed very well, were able to get good blue-collar jobs, buy their own homes, have vacations, own cars, not really worry too much about day-to-day survival. And then many of my cousins really do, and some have been lost to addiction. And so this is a very personal story for me as well. There's a political science idea called the J curve, which is that rebellions and civil unrest happens not when people are at their worst, but when they have had an opportunity and it fell and they lost ground, and that they can palpably see the distance between where they thought they were going to be and where they are.
And this is apparent throughout the Rust Belt, in places like Monoy City or Wilkes-Barre. Davidson told us about a bar he visited in Wilkes-Barre. It's called Dookie's.
Just a classic Pennsylvania bar. It's this is a real, everybody knows your name kind of bar. Everyone there was a real regular. They all knew each other. One of the guys had been named Fuzzy, had been coming there since he was 5 years old. He's 60 now. He told me he's lived in many houses, but none of them have been more than 200 yards from Dookie's. And all the people I met were exactly what I'm talking about. They were white men who had not gone to college, who had grown up in a city where they thought that was a good thing to be, that there was a lot of opportunity. And over the course of their life, they've seen that opportunity dwindle. As it happens, everyone I was talking to was doing pretty well. I mean, they all had decent jobs. One was a maintenance person at the hospital. Another person worked in one of the few factories that did remain. Someone else worked as a prison guard. These aren't jobs that'll make you rich, but they were solid, good jobs. But they saw many of their neighbors fall. They saw many of their own children and other people's children leave town if they were ambitious. They saw many of their neighbors failing. They saw crime rates going up. All the typical ills of a city that's no longer providing a meaningful living for a lot of its residents.
He also heard a lot about what's to blame for the area's downfall.
So many people were so ready to blame outsiders, to blame people in other countries, to blame immigrants. So the view being there were a lot of jobs, a lot of factories with a lot of jobs, and a lot of those factories closed and went to Mexico and then went to China is the language people used. And then what few jobs exist were taken by these new immigrants, Hispanic immigrants. It's obviously a familiar story. People say that in a lot of places in this country. And it was fascinating when I did research many of the major employers in Wilkes-Barre. There were one or two cases where that did reasonably hold up, that there had been a factory. The factory owners decided it was cheaper to make things in Mexico or Dominican Republic or China, and the factory closed. And that did happen. But that was not the core of the story. I'd say the core of the story was that already, certainly by the 60s and definitely by the 1970s, Wilkes-Barre and much of Luzerne County, where it sits, and much of Northeast Pennsylvania, was chronically underinvested in.
Let's hear more about trade, because people are always yelling about NAFTA, the 1994 North American Free Trade Agreement. So we asked Davidson whether NAFTA has done the United States any good.
You can spend much of your life, and I have done this, debating, did NAFTA hurt America? Did it help America? I would say the view I have come to, and that I think is a consensus, not a consensus, but I could get a lot more economists to agree with than not, is overall NAFTA has slightly helped America a little bit, but barely so any of us would notice. But it has hurt specific groups disproportionately. That's typical in trade, by the way. Trade generally, you know, socks go from costing $6 to costing $5.50. That's pretty good, but you wouldn't vote for it. You don't even really notice. But a whole town of sock manufacturers goes out of business. And the overall benefit is higher than the cost, but the cost is so acute that it causes political disruption and pain and et cetera. But I was able to find tons of articles and research about how already in the late 80s into the early 90s, people in Wilkes-Barre and Luzerne County are complaining about the collapsing jobs, that the factories are going out of town. And I think what I saw is this was a coal-based economy. The coal-based economy collapses sort of between the two world wars, and the population really disappears, much of it. And what replaces it is the most low-cost factories. So it became a magnet for pretty cheap, very little value-added factories, like shoes, apparel, the parts of a TV that are the least refined.
And here's why Davidson thinks northeastern Pennsylvania has slipped behind over the years.
The fact that somehow between coal disappearing, all but disappearing, it still exists to some degree, and the 1970s, 1980s, into the 1990s, that so few public officials, nonprofit folks, the several decent colleges in Wilkes-Barre in that area, that so few people said, hey, wait a second, all we have here are these really cheap, very low invested in factories, and we have a workforce that's way behind Pennsylvania and way behind the country. This isn't going to end well. It was knowable. I definitely don't want to say boy, it was easy. They would have been multimillionaires. This could have easily been the richest place in the world. But it could have been much, much better. Of course, global trade has impacted them dramatically and has broadly increased the demand for higher skill work and diminished the demand for lower skill work. And we see wages falling and job opportunities disappearing for non-college educated older men all over the country. But Northeast Pennsylvania is a unique place in the country. This is a real land of opportunity. It is really close to New York City. It's really close to Washington, D.C. It's really close to like two-thirds of the population of the United States. It's really beautiful. It's like close enough that you can really interact with these much bigger economies, but far enough away that you have cheap land prices in abundantly beautiful land.
So in theory, northeastern Pennsylvania should have a great economy, but it doesn't. And we asked Davidson what could make it better.
I don't know of a good answer for people over 50 who didn't go to college and who used to work in factories and don't now. I don't think there's a magic bullet. We can transfer wealth to them from other parts of the economy through various, you know, but a lot of those people are proud and they don't want welfare. They don't want handouts. But I think looking further into the future, it's not accepting a disorganized competitive fight for resources among lots and lots of local municipalities, but saying, hey, we're all going to do better if we do better together. And it's the citizens holding its own citizens accountable.
That was Adam Davidson, co-founder of Planet Money, and now with NewYorker.com. Coming up next, we're going to hear more about the ways some old coal towns are trying to turn themselves around. Cheryl Gay Stolberg from the New York Times will share stories with us from her reporting in Appalachia.
A lot of the work here in thinking about the future is, in a way, psychological. These are people who have been tied to the coal industry for so long and also who have been beaten down or felt so beaten down by the job losses there. It's getting people in the region to believe that their region can be something more than the coal industry.
Stolberg is the Mid-Atlantic bureau chief for the New York Times and wrote an article called Beyond Coal, Imagining Appalachia's Future. She joins us now from the studios of WAMU Public Radio in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Cheryl.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So you went to a bunch of communities in Kentucky, including Pikeville and Benham, and that's a region where the coal industry has died. More than 13,000 coal jobs, you say, lost in the last 8 years or so. Tell us also what's happening there to help the people who are out of work.
There's a lot going on in eastern Kentucky. There are all of these nascent, optimistic efforts run by people with deep ties to the land there to try to turn this region around. The idea for BitSource, which is the Pikeville company that is teaching miners how to code. It was founded by two Pikeville businessmen who run a company that is a land excavation company that lost 70% of its customers in the coal downturn. Their names are Rusty Justice and Len Parrish. And then they started thinking, what can we do to diversify our own company and to employ our own people? In the little city of Whitesburg, Apple Shop, like Appalachia, also has spun off a new tiny tech firm trying to hire local people. There are people in eastern Kentucky, former miners or people in mining-related businesses who are involved in farming. There are two people in Floyd County, Kentucky, farming. They're in the hemp farming. And all of these things together amounted to me to, I guess, the title or the headline of my story, which is Beyond Coal, Imagining Appalachia's Future.
And can you give us a feel for how many people these programs are impacting? I think this tech retraining, we're talking about a dozen people or so, right?
Yes, it's very, very small. As you mentioned, nearly 13,000 coal jobs and many, many thousands more in related industries have disappeared in Kentucky just since President Obama took office. Coal employment is at its lowest level in Kentucky since 1898. So this area, as much of coal country, was solely dependent on coal for decades and decades and decades and has lived and survived through previous booms and busts. But this bust is most people agree, not going to end. The price of natural gas is going down. That's a competitor to coal. And there's great debate over President Obama's regulations. So everybody agrees that most of these jobs are just not coming back. So this one company, BitSource, 1,000 unemployed coal workers applied for just 10 jobs. So this is small, and this is by no means an answer to the problems of Central Appalachian coal country, but it is a start.
Cheryl, how does these tech jobs that you describe, how do they compare from a point of view of salary and benefits to the jobs that the coal miners had?
Well, that's an issue. They're not really very comparable. Someone like Michael Harrison, who is a former mine electrician who I quoted in my story, he started out in the mines as a buggy man driving coal trucks 700 feet underground. He worked his way up to electrician. And he was earning almost $100,000 a year in the mines. He probably earns half that now at BitSource. But what he told me was that BitSource gave him a way not to have to leave. And that was really important to him. And look, it was a job. So we may not see these jobs coming back, even in tech or whatever other industry comes along to replace mining. I don't know, for instance, how much the prison jobs pay, say, in Manoy City. They may not pay as well. And that may be something that is lost. But at least for people like Michael Harrison, it's a way to keep his family where he is and not to have to leave.
And one thing that strikes me about your list of these new entrepreneurial businesses is that, you know, there's this shift going on where a region like Manoy City and like Eastern Kentucky used to rely solely on coal. There seems to be some diversification happening. As a matter of fact, in the article, you said that people in the region say there's no silver bullets, but rather 1,000 silver BBs to replace the lost coal jobs. So talk about that a little bit.
Well, that's absolutely right. I think everybody agrees that diversification is the key. So what's the solution? Well, the solution is going to be a lot of things. I would say the healthcare industry in a larger city like Pikeville, it may well be the largest city in eastern Kentucky with only, though, about 6,900 people. And one of the first things you'll see there is a brand new building, and it's called the Coal Building. But what's in the Coal Building is an osteopathic school attached to the University of Pikeville. I found that incredibly symbolic in a way that, you know, many people in Pikeville say healthcare is their fastest growing industry. But, you know, Eds and Meds doesn't really work for a little bitty town like Benham, Kentucky, which only has 500 people in it. It had many, many more people at the turn of the century when it was a booming captive coal town. And Eds and Meds doesn't necessarily work for a community like Whitesburg. What does work in a community like Whitesburg, which has, I think, maybe about 2,000 people or so, is the anchor institution there. And that anchor institution is this organization that I mentioned called Apple Shop. It's an arts organization that grew out of Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty. It employs filmmakers and photographers, and they have a radio station. And what they've done over the years is document and chronicle life in this region. And now they themselves are thinking, well, how can we support our community? What can we do next? And they've spun off a tiny tech firm, as I mentioned, to try to employ people there and also to try to bring young people there. That's really key, keeping young people at home.
So it seems to be there are two efforts going on in Eastern Kentucky and Manoy City and everywhere else where there's distress. And that is, you know, trying to retrain people who have lost jobs to coal or steel or whatever it is, downfall. And then also trying to keep young people from leaving. And that means jobs. It means affordable housing, obviously. And I think the affordable housing part is probably a little easier because there's some very affordable housing in these places because there's not much demand. But would you say most of the effort is to keep young people from leaving? And how are they doing at that? How's that going?
Well, I guess I would say that I have talked to so many young people there who said to me, when I grew up here, when I was in high school, all I wanted to do was get out. And, you know, teachers would be telling young people, you know, if you want to make a life for yourself, you got to get out of here. So there was this mass exodus, this incredible drain of young people and young talent. But interestingly, young people are starting to trickle back. And some people say that it's the young who will save Appalachia. I met a lot of young people who left to go to college, and they felt a tug, I guess, from the land or from home. One young woman leaps to mind. Her name is Ada Smith. She's 29, and she grew up in Whitesburg. Her dad was one of the founding members of Apple Shop. His name is Herbie Smith, and he's a filmmaker. And Ada told me that when she was in high school, literally, she just wanted to get out. And before college, she did a gap year in Seattle. She had an aunt who lived in Seattle. She thought Seattle was like the coolest place ever. They had punk rockers and music, and it was nothing like tiny little Whitesburg. And then she went off to college out west. And after college, all her friends were taking these big jobs in places like New York and Philadelphia. And she said, you know, I'm going to go home. She's now the development director at Apple Shop. And there are a lot of young people like her who have gone off and who've gotten educations and who've decided they want to reinvest in the place they call home. Another one is Todd Howard. He's a seventh-generation Kentuckian, and he's committed to staying. He's the hemp farmer I mentioned, and also his partner, Nathan Hall, who I think is also a seventh-generation Kentuckian. He's 32. He's getting his MBA at Yale, but he is also working on various farming initiatives in eastern Kentucky because he believes in the place. So I think it's going to take young people like Ada and Nathan to kind of shine a light for other young people who will say, hey, you know, I can stay, I can make a go of it here, people who are innovative and entrepreneurial. And we're seeing that happen.
And you mentioned that that Apple Shop brought in an economist to do a survey called asset mapping, which is a little different than what we hear out of these towns. So explain that to us.
This was really fascinating to me. So Apple Shop was trying to rethink its own future. And so they brought in this economist, a man by the name of Flooney Hutchinson, and he came in and he did an exercise that he called asset mapping. And the way he describes asset mapping is you come into a community and you look at its strengths, as opposed to deficit mapping, which is coming in and looking at all the things that are wrong. And what Flooney Hutchinson found in the community of Whitesburg and in Apple Shop was that there are great strengths in the beauty of the land and the resilience of the people. People in this part of the world are very tied to their land. And let's face it, they've been through a lot of rough times. The mining industry is hard work. People get injured, and there have been booms and busts. And so he tried to think about, you know, how can we take those assets and turn them into something that could be productive? And out of this sort of long, involved process, Apple Shop started doing things a little bit differently in its own organization, but it also started this Mountain Tech Media, convinced that the resilience and the flexibility of the people would provide eventually a workforce for them where young people could be taught web design, where they wouldn't have to leave home. And it's a vision. At this point, it's perhaps more aspirational than it is real. They have started. They've got a few employees. They've got, I think, 25 contracts. But it's a community-led effort. And I think that's also what people want there, is they don't want solutions imposed by Washington, although Washington has to play a role, and the Obama administration and the White House is, in fact, playing a role in the economic redevelopment of this region. But people also want to be deeply engaged in their own futures.
As a matter of fact, you talked about an organization called SOAR, and I think you said that it was formed by a Republican and a Democrat at the time, and it sort of came out of the idea that they don't want to rely on Washington for solutions, right?
Well, that's exactly right. So SOAR is shaping our Appalachian region. And in 2013, Representative Hal Rogers, who is a Republican who has been Eastern Kentucky's congressman for 35 years, got together with the state's then Democratic governor, Steve Beshear. And this is at a time where you have to remember that people in Washington were fighting over whether or not President Obama was waging a war on coal. There have been intense, intense battles and passionate fights over whether President Obama's environmental regulations, which have restricted coal-fired power plants have amounted to a war on this region. So for these two politicians, a Democrat and a Republican, to get together around this issue was a really big deal. But Hal Rogers said to me, you know, we saw our people suffering. People were losing jobs. They were out of work. We had a crisis in our region, and we had to do something. And we didn't necessarily want Washington or the White House to be scripting solutions for us. So they got together, and they formed this group called SOAR. It's a nonprofit, and it's an initiative that is really just intended to promote innovation.
At the end of the article, you quote somebody as saying, cats and dogs are sleeping together in the mountains now. Sort of a comment about how people have set aside political feuds. Can you talk more about that? And is that real or just occasional?
I think it is real. I don't think it's occasional. I think Rusty Justice, who is the co-founder of BitSource, said that to me. There's nobody more pro-coal than these founders of this little company, BitSource, the company that is teaching miners to code. Len Parrish, Rusty's partner, was so angry about the environmentalist so-called anti-coal forces that he literally printed up bumper stickers that said, mine every lump, and handed them out to his friends. So these are people who believe that Washington has ruined the coal industry. They are rabid, rabid pro-coal people. On the other side are these folks at Apple Shop who really are in the environmentalist crowd, people like Ada Smith and her father, Herbie. Yet, the folks at Apple Shop, who spun off their own little tech firm, and the folks at BitSource are meeting and getting together to talk about ways their fledgling tech companies might collaborate. And when I asked Rusty Justice about that, about the idea that would have been just crazy even 5 years ago, that he would have even been talking to anybody at Apple Shop, which was viewed as kind of the fringe left, he looked at me and he kind of smiled and he said, cats and dogs are sleeping together in the mountains now. So when I say that it's real, it is real. And that is not to say that these two groups have set aside their differences over whether or not President Obama's regulations amount to a war on coal. They will still fight over that. But they've set aside those differences enough because of their love of the land and their desire to improve life in their communities that they can now work together. And that's something new. And that's also what was new about SOAR. That's why SOAR, this bipartisan partnership, was so significant and so surprising.
As we travel around Pennsylvania reporting, we hear a lot about nostalgia, people saying they remember the way things used to be. It's a very sort of loving way to talk about a place, but it also can seem to get in people's way. It can keep them from changing and progressing. Did you run across that in Kentucky?
Yes, absolutely. I think the place that I saw that most profoundly was Benham. Because Benham was built so long ago as a coal mining camp, and because the coal companies really pulled out 30 years ago, what's left of Benham are older people and their memories. And many people there talked so fondly about the days when coal was such a bustling industry there, when the miners would tromp off to work with their lunch boxes, when the school was alive with football games, and the coal companies had baseball leagues. There are still people there who remember those days. One woman that I met said to me, the saddest day was when the railroad pulled out of town. And I think that it's hard for people to get past those memories. It's hard for them to grapple, to use your term, with the idea that that's a past that's not coming back. It's very painful.
And obviously it's very stressful for people who have seen the glory days for a community, decided not to leave for whatever reason, and then have to sort of deal day to day with blight and unemployment and psychological problems that they see around them.
I feel that you've touched on something here about the psyche of the people, that this is, for this region, it's as much a psychological awakening and a psychological reimagining. We at the Times are running a series this political year called Anxious America. So I would say this is something that we're really seeing in communities around the country, this sort of anxiousness about the future, but especially in a region like this where it is where so many jobs have been lost. And a lot of the work here in thinking about the future is, in a way, psychological. These are people who have been tied to the coal industry for so long and also who have been beaten down or felt so beaten down by the job losses there that they really can't imagine anything else for themselves and for the region. And that has been very, very important. When Rusty Justice started training these unemployed mine workers at BitSource, he told me that the biggest problem was not training them in how to code. And they were determined that they were going to prove, as he told me, that hillbillies can code. The biggest problem was getting them to think that they could do this. It was overcoming their own fear and their own views of themselves. And they actually had these training sessions, which he called reimagined training. And basically, they amounted to pep talks. He says, we told them, quit thinking of yourselves as unemployed coal workers. You are technology workers now. So I think some of this, and it's been very striking to me, is really a confidence building. It's getting people in the region to believe that their region can be something more than the coal industry. And people who are succeeding in these entrepreneurial ventures are the ones who have confidence to move ahead. Sometimes they're the ones who've gone out, who've left and acquired other skills and come back. And maybe it takes that leaving. I've wondered if it kind of takes leaving and coming back to help people see the region in a different way.
Cheryl Gay Stolberg is the Mid-Atlantic bureau chief for the New York Times. She recently wrote an article called Beyond Coal, Imagining Appalachia's Future. That wraps up our show. You can find our episodes on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Grapple is a co-production of Kuvenda Media and Keystone Crossroads, a public media initiative covering both challenges and solutions for distressed cities. Support for Keystone Crossroads comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The music on our show is composed by Tony Trove and Mike Vivas. Special thanks to our reporter, Lindsay Lazarski, and WHYY's Al Banks for engineering our show. Our executive producer is Stephanie Marudis of Kuvenda Media. And I'm Naomi Starobin, editor of Keystone Crossroads. Thanks for listening.